I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. On Wednesday, the Maryland General Assembly reconvenes in Annapolis for the 439th time. A record 73 women now hold legislative office, and for the first time since 1954, a Republican governor has been re-elected for a second term. Will Governor Larry Hogan's resounding victory in November give him a strong hand in dealing with the solidly Democratic legislature? Will the presumed price tag for education reform overshadow or possibly even animate the debate about legalizing sports betting and recreational marijuana? Will the General Assembly move on raising the minimum wage and codify in the Constitution protections for women seeking abortions? Today, a preview of the 2019 session with Ovita Wiggins of The Washington Post, Josh Kurtz of Maryland Matters, and Rachel Bay, who covers the Statehouse for WYPR. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Before we get to the topic du jour, we do have some breaking news that you may have heard this morning. Joel Fitzgerald, who is the current police chief of Fort Worth, Texas, and Mayor Pugh's nominee to be the next police commissioner of Baltimore City, has withdrawn his nomination, withdrawn his application for that job. Mayor Pugh issued a statement earlier today, about an hour ago, saying, after a lengthy discussion with Chief Joel Fitzgerald, I respect his decision to withdraw his candidacy for Baltimore Police Commissioner in order to devote his full attention to his son, who is now facing a second brain surgery tomorrow to remove a mass that was discovered late last week. Our fervent prayers are with him and his family during what is unquestionably a troubling and stressful period for them. In the meantime, Interim Commissioner Gary Tuggle is on the job and very ably managing the day-to-day affairs of the Baltimore Police Department along with his command staff. I will, of course, be communicating further on the process to select Baltimore's permanent police commissioner. It's a statement from Mayor Catherine Pugh. You'll recall that Commissioner Fitzgerald was scheduled to come to Baltimore and meet with citizens on Saturday. He did not make that trip because of this emergency medical situation with his young son. And now here we are a couple of days later, and he has decided to withdraw his application for the job. We will talk more about that tomorrow on Midday. Today, the 439th session of the Maryland General Assembly begins on Wednesday. Governor Larry Hogan comes into the session with a strong political hand following his resounding reelection victory in November. He's the first Republican to earn a second term in decades. The agenda will, as always, be full. Last year, lawmakers considered more than 3,000 bills. They passed nearly 900 of them in a record session that the governor and legislative leadership both praised as a success. The election in November saw a surge in women candidates in Congress and in state legislatures nationwide. Congress now has 127 women, 102 in the House, 25 in the Senate. That's a record for female representation. Nationwide, more than 2,000 women will serve in state legislatures. Here in Maryland, 38% of the General Assembly is now female. 57 delegates and 15 senators. That's five more than the previous record set back in 2005. Today on Midday, we've assembled a panel of Annapolitan experts who will cover the General Assembly. We'll get their take on what the hot issues will be when the gavel is struck at noon on Wednesday. Ovita Wiggins covers Maryland politics and government for The Washington Post. She's on the line from a reporting stop in Prince George's County. Ovita, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks for having me.
And with me here in Studio A, Josh Kurtz, the editor and co-founder of Maryland Matters. Good to see you, sir.
Thanks for inviting me on.
And WYPR Statehouse reporter Rachel Bay. Always a pleasure as well.
Happy to be here.
And listeners, if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to give us your take on what you think the top priorities of the Maryland legislature should be when they convene in Annapolis at noon on Wednesday, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page where we are streaming our conversation. Ovita Wiggins, let me start with you. 72 women will take their seats in the Maryland legislature in a couple of days. That is a record. What do you think that's going to portend for this session?
Well, it'll be interesting. Obviously, as you said earlier, it's going to be a busy session. But of course, I think it's going to have a pretty slow start, and largely because of so many new members to the legislature, including so many new women. This group, many of the women who decided to run, they decided after the election of President Trump and the division that we have seen in the country. Many women decided that they looked at the Me Too movement and everything that was happening in the country and decided that they needed to do something. And so there are many women who have, no legislative experience, so it'll be interesting to see how they try to have their voice in Annapolis.
There's an organization, and you talked to its executive director. The organization is called Emerge Maryland. Diane Pankova-Fink is the woman you talked to for a story you wrote just before Christmas, calling this the Hillary factor, that people saw what happened with Secretary Clinton, who was close but no cigar when it came to the presidential election. But there were people that thought that the distance between 2016 and 2018, those 2 years, maybe some of that enthusiasm from the Women's March right after the election, or right after the inauguration, rather, of President Trump, would dissipate. But it doesn't sound like that happened at all.
No, I don't think that's happened at all. As you said, Diana Fink described it as the Hillary factor. There were so many women who were energized after Hillary entered the race and were excited about the possibility of her becoming president, and then just so disappointed when she lost, that these women. Emerge is an organization that they identify women to run for office, and they had a huge number of people who showed up for who contacted them and said that they were interested in running shortly after the election. And those folks, they went through training and now are they won. Many surprised themselves, and they won and are now entering the legislature.
Yeah, fired up and ready to go, as a recent president used to say. And Rachel Bay, the Women's Caucus, which this year will be headed by Delegate Sherry Sample Hughes, I guess that's going to expand considerably from what it's been in prior years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I spoke with Delegate Sample Hughes last week about it, and she made the point that women bring different perspectives to the table, so you will see those women making an impact when it comes to the actual policies that we see coming out of Annapolis.
There was a lot of talk last year about complaints of sexual harassment, both from legislators, from lobbyists, and people just in the general Annapolis community. Where did things stand with that? Remember, there was a big celebrated case of Kurt Anderson, who was, had some very serious allegations of sexual harassment against him. He was reelected. Where do things stand, for example, with Delegate Anderson?
Well, Delegate Anderson has been stripped of his leadership positions in the House. So his voters reelected him. So fair and square, he is going back to the General Assembly, but he won't be holding those leadership positions anymore. Also of note, there was a report out from the Department of Legislative Services under some rules passed, created last year. They are now required to release an annual report showing how many complaints have been submitted of sexual harassment. And the report was that there were 17 complaints made in the past year as of, I believe it was November. And 11 of those were legislators. Now, we don't, other than Kurt Anderson, we don't know who those complaints were made about or really any of the details of those complaints, just that 11 complaints were made against legislators.
Do you expect at some point that those names would be released, that those reports would become public fodder?
Probably not. Mm-hmm. I mean, what we understand is that there was some investigation into some of these complaints, and that nothing has come of them. If something had come of these investigations, we would know. That would be made public. But given that apparently they were investigated and nothing came of it, that's about all we're going to know.
Mm-hmm. And Josh Kurtz, what do you think about Larry Hogan's hand as he begins this second term? It's his final term. He's term limited. He's not running for anything again, or at least for governor again. And there are a lot of folks who speculated that perhaps he would veer to the right. He would become more conservative in a second term than he was in a first term. Any talk about that this week?
We haven't seen any evidence of him veering to the right yet. And it's unclear whether he actually will. He on the one hand, he does have a strong hand, but he actually hasn't shown his hand either. He hasn't said a lot about what he wants to do either this year or in a second term. He's kind of laid out a few broad themes. He said he expects his second term to be very much like his first term. But we don't really know what the agenda is yet. And, I think this is a governor who likes to be popular, who knows when to pick his fights. And remember, the Republicans fell well short of their goal to flip 5 state Senate seats in the election. Democrats actually picked up, I believe, 8 seats in the House of Delegates. So their hand has been strengthened as well. And a bunch of Democrats are proceeding almost as if the governor isn't there, isn't a factor. So these are kind of conflicting things going on.
Yeah,
so,
the famous drive for 5,
right?
We heard about, because if the Senate had picked up 5 Republican seats, that would be a sort of veto-proof majority,
right,
for or a veto-proof complement for the governor. So they,
right,
his vetoes would be sustained.
Right, and they only picked up 1 seat in the Senate.
Yeah. And Ovita Wiggins sort of overshadowing a lot of this, if not every single bit of legislation that'll be coming down the pike this year, is the Kerwin Commission, and their expected and presumed very big price tag for education reform. Britt Kerwin was on our show last summer in August, and he assured me that the results of the Kerwin Commission, the recommendations for a funding formula, et cetera, would be released before the election. That didn't happen. Then it was before the assembly reconvened. That's not going to happen. What's your take? What's your latest reporting telling you about the timetable for the Kerwin Commission to issue its recommendations?
Well, at this point, we don't know when they will release their final recommendation. As you said, there have been 2 delays. We had expected it before the election, and then definitely we're told that it would happen before session. What we do know is the commission was responsible for, they had 2 tasks, actually, to figure out a way to transform Maryland's public system, to turn it into, the best performing system in the world. And they came up with recommendations, policy recommendations for that in their preliminary report, but they never came, and they also came up with a price tag for it. What they did not come to a resolution on is how to divide the costs. How much would the state have to pay? How much would the local governments have to pay? And so what the legislature will take up this session will be many of the things that were in the preliminary report from the Kerwin Commission. Last session, they set aside $200 million for some of the policy recommendations, as well as the Kerwin Commission has recommended that $125 million is used, taken from the lockbox, the casino money, that money is used for education and used for the recommendations of the Kerwin Commission. The question is whether that will actually happen. Obviously, that's what the legislature, the Democrats, want to see happen, to begin the process of funding the Kerwin Commission recommendations. But on the flip side, you have Governor Hogan several weeks ago announced that he wants to use money from the lockbox to pay for school construction. So that appears to be what will appear to be the major battle in the legislature involving education, whether the money from the lockbox will be used for school construction, or whether it will be used for in the classroom.
And we have a listener from Washington County, John, pings us on Facebook and says, what do you think will happen with education? Many of the schools here in Washington County need help, and our delegate, Neil Parrott, is too busy supporting Trump to help the people here. So clearly this is on the minds of folks not just in Baltimore City but around the state. That's Ovita Wiggins, who covers Maryland politics and government for The Washington Post. Here in the studio with me, Josh Kurtz. He's the editor and co-founder of Maryland Matters, which focuses on all things Annapolis at this time of year in particular, and Rachel Bay, who covers the State House for WYPR. We'll have more of our preview of the 2019 General Assembly when we come back. You are welcome to join us. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page, where we are streaming live from Studio A. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, as we mentioned at the top of today's show, Fort Worth Police Commissioner Joel Fitzgerald has withdrawn his bid to be Baltimore's next police commissioner. So we'll talk about what that means for the beleaguered Baltimore Police Department moving forward. That's coming up tomorrow. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about what we can expect in the 2019 Maryland General Assembly, which gets underway on Wednesday. I'm joined today by three excellent reporters who keep an eye on all things Annapolis: WYPR reporter Rachel Bay, Washington Post reporter Ovita Wiggins, and Josh Kurtz, the editor and co-founder of Maryland Matters. You are welcome to join our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR, and you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Rachel Bay, you had a sit down with Mike Miller, the Senate president, a couple weeks ago. What do you have to say? What's top on his mind? For example, did you talk a little bit about Kerwin and the presumed recommendations?
Yeah, he mentioned that the Kerwin Commission wouldn't be coming out with its formula by the time of the coming session. But he did say that, from what he understands, is that the Kerwin Commission is trying to reduce that $4 billion price tag a little bit before they do release their final formula. And he showed that he was ready for some battles with the governor, for sure, on education, and specifically on that school construction proposal that the governor mentioned a few weeks ago. He said he doesn't take it seriously, that it was a PR stunt, and that if the governor were serious about funding school construction money, school construction, he would have sat down with the legislative leaders and hashed out a plan and wouldn't have picked fights over school construction funding last year, for example.
The governor announced with some fanfare proposing $1.9 billion from the casino funds. This is lockbox money for school construction over the next 5 years. But the Senate president thinks that's just a PR stunt.
He said he didn't take it seriously. Among his other priorities, he mentioned curbing violence in Baltimore was a big one, and particularly helping Mayor Catherine Pugh with police recruitment issues. He came out firmly in support of a few policies there, which I think you're going to get to in a little bit. But he had other priorities, including some environmental proposals, increasing the amount of renewable energy that the state is using to 50% by 2030, which is a proposal that's coming back from last year. And also, he came out firmly in support of a plan related to health insurance, creating an individual mandate in Maryland and allowing Marylanders to use that mandate payment, that penalty payment, to as a down payment on a health insurance plan.
Mm-hmm. And Josh Kurtz, a lot of people sort of think that, you know, Mike Miller was elected just after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. I mean, he's been in office a long time.
Right.
What's his hand like? Peter Franchot announced the other day that there's about $1 billion of surplus revenue, whatever that means, lying around the coffers here. Do you expect a big, you know, sort of philosophical battle about how to spend this perhaps fictional money.
Huh. Inevitably, there'll be a philosophical battle. The money isn't necessarily fictional, but I think there's some sense of caution that they, because they see sort of structural deficits coming down the line, a couple of years down the line. So this $1 billion is a nice thing to play around with, but they're probably not going to get too over-exuberant with it. But there is going to be a philosophical battle, and actually I think there will be philosophical battles within the House and Senate Democratic caucuses too, because you're right, Senator Miller, he's been Senate president since 1987. His caucus has moved considerably to the left in the time he's been there and is now considerably to the left of him. And to a lesser extent, you have the same phenomenon going on in the House, and particularly a bunch of the newcomers, the Democrats, are quite progressive, and they're going to want to push back against both the governor and against sort of the more cautious instincts of their leaders, I think.
Both Mike Miller and Mike Bush, who's heads up the House, are in their 70s. Mr. Bush has had some health problems of late. And there was, it seems to me, more of a movement this time around, this last election cycle, to oust them than there had been in the past. Now, it didn't work. It didn't work by a long shot. But it was almost, apostasy in years past to even consider, putting up a candidate in a primary against a Mike Miller or a Mike Bush. I mean, are they as strong as ever?
I think in the short run they are. I think they're both, they're just extremely accomplished inside players, and they're fairly well respected within their chambers. But I think there's also a sense that, their time is passing, and that, it may not be in this legislative term, but certainly, not too much longer, there's going to be significant change in both chambers. And I think a lot of people are aware of that.
It is worth noting that while Miller retained his seat, several of his allies in the Senate did not. And that's that the chamber as a whole has become younger, and not just more progressive, but actually younger. And he's, I think, having to cross those divides a little more than he may have had to do a couple of years ago.
Yeah. And Ovita Wiggins, you wrote a piece for the Post a couple days before Christmas about the odds, which you evidently think are pretty good, that something like sports betting could be passed this term as a revenue source. Where does that stand?
Yeah. When I sat down with the governor, he said that he thought that the Senate president and the speaker would come to some type of agreement on sports betting. I had a sit down with the Senate president, last week, and he said that he would agree with that. The question is whether that will actually happen this session or whether it will wait until next session. Some of the issues that surround that involve, if they were to pass sports betting, it would have to be a constitutional amendment, which means it would have to go before the voters. That's one way of doing it. And if they're going to take it before the voters, most likely they would wait and do that next session in the 2020 session. But Miller also noted that there's a possibility of sort of circumventing that, bringing it before the voters and allowing sports betting to be regulated by the lottery. If that is done, then they would likely pass the bill this year. What they're hoping to do is to get some agreement from the casinos and the racetrack owners, and if they are able to get that agreement, then we will likely see sports betting regulated by the lottery and legislation passing this session.
Ovita Wiggins covers Maryland politics for The Washington Post. She's on the line from Prince George's County. Here in the studio with me, Rachel Bay, who covers the State House for WIPR, and Josh Kurtz. He's the editor and co-founder of Maryland Matters, a terrific website which focuses on all things Annapolis. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to drop us a tweet, @MiddayWIPR. You can also catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. You are listening to Midday. Let's go to the phones to Mark in Catonsville. Mark, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. I just wanted to highlight the latest version of the Clean Energy Jobs Act. which I hope will pass. There's some compromises in it. Notably, the black liquor will be included as a renewable source. So that's too bad. But there's
And remind folks what black liquor do. Black liquor is a byproduct of some certain processes that in and of itself is a contaminant, right? And somehow
we could debate it, but yeah, it's a byproduct of paper manufacturing, what they call the craft process of paper. But technically it is a renewable because it's from trees, but we can do better. But there's some jobs at stake, and labor was adamant, as I understand it, to include this so as to save the paper industry in Maryland. So that was included, but upping the whole standard to 50% is a big deal. Plus, there's a solar carve-out. It's kind of complicated, but that's going to be increased to 14.5%, as I understand it.
All right, well,
that's a big deal.
Yeah, thanks for that call, Mark. And Josh Kurtz, this represents the bill calls for half of our energy to come from renewable sources by 2030. So it's another 12 years, 11 years. Is that one of those things? I mean, we have the governor siding with the Democrats when it came to fracking during his first term. Does this seem like something that has a pretty good chance of getting through?
I think it has a very good chance of getting through both the houses of the legislature, and I think it's actually a pretty high priority for the Democratic leaders in both chambers. Little less clear what Governor Hogan is going to do. Also less clear what would happen if he vetoed it, whether there'd be enough support to override. But I do think it's going to pass initially. Governor Hogan has been, he's been, for a Republican, he's been quite good on the environment. I think even environmentalists would admit that. He's been a little more reluctant to embrace some of these kind of mandates. First time around, in his first term, there was a clean energy bill that he vetoed, though. The legislature overrode it, and it became law, I believe, in 2016 or 17.
It sounds like the governor is really keeping his cards close to the chest. I mean, he is not coming out with a big agenda that says, here are the priorities I have, here are the things I'm really going to push for. He's in a wait-and-see mode, isn't he?
And I think part of that is just, bowing to reality, because he knows he's dealing with Democratic supermajorities. He knows it's still nominally, still a Democratic state. He can read numbers as well as anybody. He did. He had a smashing reelection victory, but
he probably reads them better than most people.
Right, yeah, exactly. And he had a smashing reelection victory, but it didn't translate down ballot, and he's well aware of that.
Julie sends us an email and says, "What is the political calculus for waiting until 2020 to put recreational marijuana on the general ballot, as opposed to doing it legislatively when it polled so well in the 2018 election? The recreational marijuana seems like the most obvious way to get revenue that will be needed for the upcoming Kerwin recommendations, but to wait until 2020 and then several years of rollout would not make the funds available for 5 to 7 years. So, Evita Wiggins, when it comes to sports betting, that's something the governor has said he would certainly consider. Recreational marijuana, maybe not so much.
That's right, not so much. He has said that that there has been a lot of hiccups in the rollout of medical marijuana, and so he's concerned about rushing too quickly into approving recreational marijuana.
And how much, Evita Wiggins, how much are we talking about when it comes to potential revenue for the state of Maryland? When I interviewed everybody running for the Democratic nomination for governor over the last election cycle, virtually all of them, with the exception of Rashern Baker, said they supported a recreational marijuana industry to create huge revenue that was going to pay for all sorts of ideas that they had. I mean, are we talking about big money? Are there examples from other states that show us that either sports betting or recreational marijuana are these panaceas that some lawmakers seem to think they are?
Well, I think one of the issues in regards to sports betting, which Senator Miller mentioned to me, was the fact that he does not want to see Maryland come in so late. You have so many other states that have already started with sports betting. Delaware. I know Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania. So Maryland is already behind in with sports betting and getting that revenue from those who want to bet on professional sports. Sports betting does not give as much revenue as recreational marijuana. I don't have those numbers at my fingertips, but I was told that sports betting would not obviously provide the state with the cash cow that recreational marijuana would.
Rachel Bay, let's talk a little bit about gerrymandering. There was a Supreme Court ruling that just happened on Friday regarding that. Tell us the latest on that situation.
So it actually wasn't a ruling. The Supreme Court said they would take the challenge to Maryland's 6th Congressional District. This is a case the federal court had basically told the state they needed to redraw the 6th District, which is the Western Maryland District, that was created in such a way that it gets some Democratic votes from Potomac in order to help Democrats in Congress win that extra seat. It helped unseat Congressman Roscoe Bartlett in 2012. So the Supreme Court is going to hear that. But in the meantime, Larry Hogan has also appointed a commission to oversee the redrawing of the 6th District, and they had their first meeting on Friday, and they're moving ahead alongside the Supreme Court, effectively. So there's currently a July deadline to release a new map. It was originally earlier than that. So the commission, set by the court, so the commission is going to release its proposed map, including a new 6th district and probably some shifted other districts as a result of that new 6th district, to the General Assembly no later than one week before the session ends on April 2nd, giving the legislators enough time to approve that map or not. But I also spoke with Senate President Miller about this, and he effectively said, I'm waiting to see what the Supreme Court does. We're not ready to play ball on this just yet.
So, Josh Kurtz, the 6th District was a seat held by John Delaney, who gave up the seat to run for president. There was a very hotly contested Democratic primary for that. David Trohn, survived that and then has gone on to become elected to that seat. Mm-hmm. Can they redistrict just the 6th District without messing up the other 7?
I don't think so. It's sort of like a stone in a pond. There's going to be ripple effects. At the very least, it's going to affect the adjoining districts, and I think the 8th district in particular. But in fact, I think invariably it's going to go farther than that. And if in fact some new boundaries in the 6th come in, there'll be new boundaries in several other districts as well.
And the Supreme Court has taken this issue up before,
right?
And they sort of punted it. They basically said, I mean, Elena Kagan and some others have said, this is not a matter for the courts. The legislative remedy is the best way to go here. What's different now?
Well, it's a good question. They also agreed to take on a North Carolina case where the district lines are also heavily gerrymandered in favor of the Republicans. But you're right, the Supreme Court has been reluctant to sort of take this on broadly or set any kind of national standards. Whether that's going to change, it kind of remains to be seen. But I think, we're seeing more court-mandated congressional maps than we have in the past. So that may be something that's going on there.
Of course, in Pennsylvania, that ended up being redistricted by the Supreme Court of the U.S., by the state Supreme Court. So that was a different different strategy there for people trying to do that. We will talk some more about that and other stuff on the agenda for the 2019 Maryland General Assembly when we come back with Ovita Wiggins, who covers Maryland politics and government for The Washington Post, Josh Kurtz. He and his team keep an eye on all things Annapolis for Maryland Matters, and Rachel Bay, who covers the State House for WYPR. We're going to take a quick break, but before we do that, a note about our practice of reading the names of all of the homicide victims in Baltimore City. We read them every week on Monday here on Midday. In all, our city recorded 309 homicides last year. 13 of those victims had been killed in previous years, and their deaths were declared homicides in 2018. One of those victims was Clinton Anderson. He was 49 years old. He was shot in 2007. He died in November, and the city medical examiner ruled his death a homicide. Police reported it on December 31st. We were on our holiday break the last two Mondays of 2018, so this is the first chance we've had to recognize the victims who did lose their lives to violence during the final 2 weeks of last year. They are Musa Mohammed Jaber, age 64, Terrell Davis, age 25, Garnet Kennedy, age 24, Rodney Beeman Jr., age 32, William Barnes, age 53, Mayon Mejia, age 49, Marquise Richardson, age 30, Damian Clarity, age 18, Marcus Barber, age 24, Ronald Armstrong, age 59. And as we enter the second week of this new year, already four people have lost their lives to violence in our city. Baltimore police have released the names of three of them. They are Ikeem Isaac, age 28, Tavon Hammond, age 33, and Troy Harrison, who was 55 years old. We read the names of these victims every week to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and their friends in their hour of grief. There were 36 fewer homicides in Baltimore in 2018 than there were in 2017. Some have asserted correctly that this represents a 10% reduction in murders, but none of us should consider it acceptable. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. The 439th session of the Maryland General Assembly will convene on Wednesday. Over the next 3 months, representatives in the House and the Senate will weigh legislative proposals on a myriad of issues, from provisions in the Affordable Care Act and immigration to the banning of styrofoam, among other things. WYPR State House reporter Rachel Bay and Josh Kurtz of Maryland Matters are here with me in Studio A, and joining us on the line from Prince George's County is Washington Post reporter Ovita Wiggins. You are welcome to join our conversation as well. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet at midday WYPR, to follow me on Twitter, which you are cordially required to do. It's at Tom Hall WYPR, and you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Ovita Wiggins, the fight for 15. This is a fight that's been going on a long time. What are the chances of the minimum wage being raised statewide to $15 an hour?
Well, it will definitely be raised. The question is whether it will be statewide. Speaker Bush obviously is a proponent of raising the minimum wage. Senate President Miller, the bill has always sort of stalled in the Senate. When I sat down with him last week, he said that it's going to happen. The question is how. And I think that there are some concerns about how it will affect Western Maryland and the Eastern Shore, whether there will be a different phase in or a different amount, how that will phase in those areas. The governor is not necessarily excited about the idea. He has taken a similar position that he took with the paid sick leave bill initially, in which he talks about his concerns about how it will hurt small businesses and whether it is the right thing to do. So I think that will be another issue. It will likely pass the legislature. The question is in what form, and then whether there will be enough votes to do a veto override.
And Josh Kurtz, does that sound about right to you? I mean, this is one of those things I think that it's really confusing for folks because there's battling data about this. So the proponents of an increased minimum wage say there's no effect on small businesses, there's no effect on the local economy, that the only effect is a good thing because people have more money in their pockets and they spend more. You get these reports from Seattle and places that have done it and everything's working out beautifully. And then you have a whole other set of reports and data from people who oppose raising the minimum wage, who report that it's exactly the opposite and it's the worst thing since, you know, the Second World War. So what's your take on the general feeling of the legislature as to whether or not there is, in fact, a huge impact on small businesses if they are obliged to pay their employees $15 a shot?
I think, you know, you're right. There, I think both arguments are out there, and I think people are paying attention to them. But I think just politically, there's a lot of pressure on Democrats to pass this now. This has been sort of one of the major things that mobilized Democratic allies and interest groups in the last election. And so I think the Democrats, as Ovita said, are going to pass something for sure. And then, you know, some of the details and what Governor Hogan does then have to be determined. But they're under a lot of pressure, so they're going to do something.
Let's go to the phones to Gabrielle in Annapolis. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling. Happy New Year.
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am. You are on the air. What's on
your
mind?
I'm a little off. I've been waiting, so you switch subjects, so I'll make it brief. I lived here from 67 to 77 when I was a young person. Now I'm an old person, and I've lived here since 2008. And I just don't understand how Maryland has turned into a great big carnival with all this gambling and sports betting and medical marijuana and recreational marijuana. I don't care about those things, but what I do care is the fact that, like in most states, I can go into a drugstore or a Trader Joe's or a grocery store and buy a bottle of vodka if I want, but not here. It's verboten. Have you guys just forgotten about this liquor problem, or is it just hopeless?
All right, Gabrielle, I appreciate the comment. Rachel Bay, Peter Franchot got involved in the beer-making industry in a big way the last time. He has sort of been slapped back a little bit by the legislative leadership. What's up with alcohol? Are you on top of that?
He is trying again with the beer regulations. There's been a lot of debate about the heart of the issue, and this is not exactly speaking to what the caller just mentioned, but the heart of the issue is helping specifically breweries sell their product on site and making it kind of easier, lightening up some of the beer regulations. Franchot has tried the last couple of years to do this and hasn't really accomplished what he was setting out to do. So we'll see where that goes this year.
Yeah, so there's a whole lot of different ways to skin this cat. I mean, states like New Hampshire, for example, the only place you can buy liquor and beer and wine is in state-run stores. So the state gets all of the revenue from it. They are in the business of selling spirits. So, I'm not sure, Gabrielle, if we're going to have vodka in Trader Joe's anytime soon. But if it happens, you'll be the first to know about it because we'll tell you right here on Midday. Let's go back to the phones to Toby in Towson. Toby, welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
What's on your mind?
I was interested in knowing if the legislature was going to take up the issue of the federal tax changes that took place last year that had an impact on Maryland taxpayers. And my understanding was the legislature was not going to address the issue last year because they ostensibly didn't have enough information. And here we are with another legislative session. And my question is there any hope that the legislature will address this issue see that the Maryland taxpayers are not taxed an additional amount of money just because of the federal tax changes?
Rachel, you want to take that? I mean, last year, of course, with the changes to the federal tax code, Maryland's tax code is somehow linked to the federal tax code. And irony is that this big tax cut that the Republicans promised the country for many people here in Maryland was going to end up being a tax increase. They did address it to a certain extent last year in the session, and I bet it's on people's minds again this year.
Yeah, I don't know if they're planning to do any more than they did last year. Last year, they did actually take it up, and there was a lot of debate about the governor wanted to give to basically completely protect the Maryland taxpayer from the effects of this and make sure that all of that money that they are going to be taxed additionally, they end up getting back in some form. That's not quite how it broke down, but the state did kind of buffer the effects to some extent from the Maryland taxpayer. But they didn't quite go, I think, as far as the governor wanted them to do. But I don't see that necessarily coming back. I think that what's done there is done.
Let's go back to the phones to Dick in Baltimore. Dick, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is for Oveta, and I want to know whether she thinks the Forest Conservation Act amendment has any chance of being brought to the floor for a vote in this session.
All right, Oveta Wiggins, what do you think?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what
the question was about. The Forest Conservation Act amendment, do you think that it will make its way to the floor in this session?
I am not certain about that. Maybe Rachel or Josh may know.
Do you guys know?
Don't.
All right.
Sorry.
Well, Dick, you have stumped the panel because none of us have any idea what the Forest Conservation Act Amendment is.
We'll check it out as soon as we get out of here.
We will check it out as soon as we leave. But for now, I'm sorry I can't answer that question. But, Oveta, the Legislative Black Caucus has announced its priorities for the session. One of them seems to be to raise the age for buying tobacco to 21. What are the prospects for that?
It's interesting that the two sponsors of that bill are two chairs of committees that the legislation would likely go through. That's Senator Kelly and Delegate Davis, both who are members of the Legislative Black Caucus. And they've described this as one of their top agenda items, raising the age from 18 to 21. A lot of cities across the state, a lot of states, including Chicago, the district recently did it as well. So the prospects, you know, we will wait and see whether they're able to gain enough momentum among their colleagues, but the caucus itself has a large block of voters, so we'll see whether they're able to do this.
And Josh Kurtz is going to give you the last word. We just have a few seconds left. There's a movement to make a mandate for people in Maryland to purchase insurance to counter the effects of this tax law that the Republican Congress passed a year ago. What are the prospects for that?
I think there's a pretty decent chance it gets out of the legislature. Governor Hogan has expressed some reservations. So, again, then you get into the question of, you know, do they have the votes to override if, in fact, it gets out?
Yeah, the override issue is really going to be interesting this year because, you know, the governor is not going to be running for re-election as governor, although there are plenty of people who think he should be running for president, and we'll see what happens with that, too. But all right, well, it's been great talking to all of you. Thank you so much. We look forward to your reporting as we go through. Rachel Bay, Josh Kurtz, and Oveta Wiggins. Thanks to everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rachel Bay covers Maryland politics for WYPR. Josh Kurtz edits, and he is the co-founder of Maryland Matters. And Oveta Wiggins covers the State House for The Washington Post. We've got links to the excellent reporting from all three of our guests at WIPR.org/midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, what's next for the Baltimore City Police Department now that Joel Fitzgerald, who's Mayor Pugh's choice to be the next police chief, has withdrawn his application for the job. So we'll talk about that tomorrow here on Midday. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner, with breakfast served on the weekends. You can find them on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. I'm Tom Hall, here and now, coming up after a break for news at the top of the hour. On behalf of the entire Midday team, thanks for listening. Have a great day.